Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
And good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. Storms in the area and stormy enough and potentially stormy enough tonight to cancel Night Market. They only have like four scheduled, so that's a big deal.
They usually get moved.
Yeah.
If one gets canceled, then there ends up being one in the later months, which is great because my experience since moving back to Wisconsin is that fall is warmer and warmer, and that really into like October, you don't necessarily need a jacket.
Yeah, I was thinking about that last night. I was attending a game in Illinois watching my grandson Max play, and it was cold that night. The wind off the lake, Winnetka. And thankfully, Max's team won, so it wasn't that bad. But it was, we're talking amongst us in the crowd, and it's like, man, June feels like September, like late September. It's like cold.
It's going to be hot next week.
Yeah.
I think it's getting in the 80s next week. We'll
that's the real summer. All right. So we talk about politics on this show, and the dynamic element that's happening, sort of the game-changing moment for New York, the state of New York, is that this rise, not just the city of New York, but the state of New York, and there was a big elections last night, and Democratic Socialists are doing very well.
Swept.
Yeah.
They swept. So New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani swept the first major test of his political influence within the city. And so it was three big races. One was a huge upset as far as a five-term Democratic congressman, Adriano Espaillat.
I saw the name. It's hard to say.
And he's, but he's also the head of the Hispanic caucus for Democrats. And so big loss for the Democratic establishment. So he lost. Claire Valdez was a New York Assembly member. She was declared the winner in Brooklyn's 7th Congressional District. And then Brad Lander, who was the comptroller, who had also been running for mayor and became really good friends with Mamdani. He beat the incumbent Congressman Dan Goldman, who was two terms.
So you lean left. What's the significance?
This is what I think is fascinating. So I saw reactions last night and this morning from progressive DSA type folks online being obviously very excited, touting this as a signal of what voters want, of where the party needs to move. But this is also pretty much in contrast to what we saw in California at the beginning of the month, I think, right? As far as I feel like the story that came out of the California primaries was more establishment, safer, and a lot of the far left candidates didn't fare as well. Like even Katie Porter in the fallout of Swalwell, like Becerra got those votes instead of Porter, right? And so I think it's interesting because on its face, what does that tell us? And I think more of the story is probably in the nitty gritty of one, the power of Mamdani's just endorsement and him stumping really hard for people, two, how organized DSA is in New York compared to the entire state, especially New York City, compared to the entire state of California and what the structure is there versus in New York. But I do think it shows, and I was thinking about this because like how it relates to Wisconsin, right? Because that's what most of our listeners care about.
Yeah, we talked about it yesterday, Fran Hong, her success.
And it is what happened in New York is exactly what the momentum behind Fran is. And the question here is, it's a purple state versus a blue state. But there is something to be said as far as the on the left, from moderate to even further left, there is a anger of standing up to Trump, of how Bernie got screwed back in 2016, about all of these things as far as their voice not being heard, and wanting someone who speaks as passionately as a Francesca Hong, as a Mamdani, and wanting change, and feeling like there is a growing sentiment that the people who've just been in there forever are not delivering the kind of results that people are desperately wanting.
That unsettledness of the voting members of our communities is, I think, a big part of this. People are like, they're pissed off.
But that's not new, right? I think Zepecki talks about this all the time as far as like how many change elections we've had. And not just in this country, but across the globe, right? Starmer just stepped down.
Yeah.
And so there is a growing sentiment of like, what's like, and then we talked about this in the State of the State report, the State of the States report we were talking about yesterday, as far as like, no state is getting like better at any kind of like noticeable trend line of across all of these different things, and that there is a stagnation of progress and an improvement of people's status and how they're feeling about their finances, their life, their opportunities. And like, and the only way to potentially change that is to swing votes or go further right or go further left.
How does that fly in the face of what we were talking about? I was talking about yesterday with sort of the dropping out of Missy Hughes and potentially some one or two other candidates that sort of to shift the focus to a more, if she could be called a moderate, Sarah Rodriguez type candidate versus the far left candidates. How does that jive with what's going on in New York, do you think? Or is it completely unrelated?
I think it's I don't know. It's hard to tell. I think it was interesting because I have, as you mentioned, like all the different, as you do too, all the different friends and jabbering we hear offline in text messages and text threads and social media and stuff. And I think I have an interesting purview because I work here, right? Like I think getting to work at Journal Sentinel, I am exposed to a wider range of thoughts and opinions from our listeners, from readers, than you necessarily get when you're in your echo chamber online. And so, but that said, I also have not done like the groundwork of traveling all over the state and talking to a lot of people. So it's hard to really test what is the actual sentiment of moderate to left voters, who's actually going to show up in August. But I think what's interesting, because there is in the similar vein as what, because we got feedback yesterday on our video that we posted as far as in a Tom Tiffany, Fran Hong election, what do moderates do? Because there was people who took issue with calling her extreme. But I will say these three, Brad Lander not so much, but two of the candidates who just won the primary in New York have said some pretty extreme things. Mm-hmm. And I think that now becomes a litmus test for Republicans to push every single Democrat in an election, a general election of like, do you agree with these sentiments? Whether that's about Gaza, whether that's about ICE, whether that's about police, of definitively having to say where you stand in comparison to DSA candidates.
It's an interesting point you just made there, because there's this expectation that people have now, and this is just me saying this, that you have to have a definitive stance on every issue.
Mm.
Everything we say, you have to, that's the black and white of it.
Yeah.
Anyone who lives in the real world knows that's not the way it works. There are nuance. There's nuance. There's this gray. But we just demand an answer. You hear it on talk radio all the time. This is the way it has to be. No one lives in that reality. If you're in a relationship, it's not like that. Certainly, there's yin and yang, give and take, all of that stuff. So why would we expect that there's going to be a definitive answer on every issue that faces us in politics? But yet that's our expectations. And I would argue if you go on the other side of the aisle, they're just as angry and just as unsettled.
We're going to talk about that later. It's about two prominent people leaving the Republican Party.
Yeah. I wouldn't have guessed that like 3 or 4 years ago, but here we are. I mean, that's the nature of this. And I put in our notes, I think this is a fascinating time to, one, talk about politics, but two, live that, because this fall's elections could do a lot of different things. One, make the president's life miserable, if it's not miserable already, because of all the stuff that's swirling around him. And some great reporting that I'm just going to start reading pretty soon, Regime Change, by two great writers, whose name, Maggie Haberman
and David Swan.
David Swan, yeah, just brilliant writers. I can't wait to dig into it. I'll get it today. But there's just this wildness of this election. And the president today, just to put a cap on this before we move on, to sort of, I want to define social...
Democratic socialism?
Yeah,
you want me to look up the definition of commercial?
I put it on the outline.
Oh, okay.
And a friend of mine made an interesting point about this yesterday in an email exchange, or actually a text exchange. But the president just blew up a bipartisan meeting on a bill.
A historic 30-year housing affordability
to make
act
it affordable.
This is the biggest thing as far as both being bipartisan and actually making huge moves for the first time in 3 decades on trying to build more housing. And he is blocking it until they pass the SAVE Act.
He's pissed about it. And it's the ultimate political tantrum. Lots more to come. Point taken. Talking politics, as we often do on Point Taken. Kristen Bryce, this video, your hosts. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. You can always find us if you missed the live version. YouTube, you can search it on all your podcast platforms. And we do a ton of work, thanks to Jazz Producer and Kristen's great work on social media. We're all over the place with reels and posts and Just little snapshots, little vignettes of what we do, sort of capturing the fun of the program, but also some of the serious things that we do as well. So thanks for consuming all of that. Don't forget, don't sleep on that newsletter too, which is one of the best new newsletters out there on politics and more. All right. So this is a little bit long-winded, but I wanted to define, and this is gathered from a couple sources online, what Democratic socialism, political ideology, makes sense, that supports political democracy alongside a socially owned economy with a strong emphasis on economic democracy, workplace democracy, and workers' self-management. It seeks to replace capitalism with a decentralized, democratically run socialist economy where ordinary people have real control over workplaces, neighborhoods, and society. That's the sort of
amalgamate. So how do you interpret that? Because it's kind of...
Want to give you? I'll give you my conservative opinion.
Sure, yeah, do it.
It's a bunch of people who have never run a business trying to tell the management how to run a business. But beyond that, a friend of mine made a great point yesterday as we were talking about this.
It is different than like communism, though. I think sometimes people
clearly
conflate socialism and communism. It's not that the government owns all property and means of production. Like there is points that you can make to Nordic countries of more public-private relationships, more things that are like actual resources and how they go to serve the entirety of the population rather than the company that is extracting them, et cetera, et cetera. But go ahead.
Happy workers, happy country, happy life, basically.
I mean, they are happy countries.
Yeah.
Despite having very little daylight for half the year.
It's true, yeah. You made the connection to the changing climate. Yeah, and to the...
Lots of daylight right now, though.
All right, so a friend of mine was making this point last night, and he's a business owner. He described democratic socialism as a system where everybody gets the benefits typically bargained for by unions without having to pay the dues. And union membership, as we know, has been declining steadily for decades. I just picked up a couple numbers from the heyday way back in the mid 20th century. It was 28%, 25%. It's down to 10%.
What is down to 10%?
Union membership.
Oh,
paid dues paying members of union. 10%.
Well, there was a lot of effort to bust unions.
True.
I'm not sure that was just like a natural erosion of people not wanting to be in unions anymore versus like policy decisions that broke them.
Not claiming otherwise, but it does prompt me to ask you this question. Regardless of how it happened, to have that small of a percentage, which is very small, 1 in 10, represented by unions, but yet we're claiming that the main impetus of democratic socialism is to sort of get that same power.
I'm sure your friend made that point. I'm not sure
that's why I'm asking you to comment on
it. I think the more honest claim of DSA policies, whether they actually happen or not, and what the negative externalities are of those policies, I think the simple value proposition is with democratic socialist policies, anybody can be rich, but nobody's going to be poor. And that, like,
is that realistic?
I don't know, but I think that what we have right now in being the richest country in the world, and how many people live on a razor's edge of poverty and homelessness and bankruptcy, something's not quite right.
Sure.
And how much money is accumulated at the top because those are also policy decisions. That's not just like good businessmen. Like that is also an allowance to let those things happen and also let people fall through the cracks.
There's a ton
of social research that shows like this much wealth inequality is not good for a society as far as our stability.
I agree. There's a huge disparity, but does that justify blowing up capitalism?
But what is your interpretation of how this would blow up capitalism?
It sounds like you're taking all the power, leadership power, from the managers, owners, shareholders, and giving it to the employees. So everything's employee owned, so basically.
I don't think that's what. So let's run down Francesca Tong's policies. So free school meals, universal childcare, support childcare providers, fully fund public schools, roll back unfair voucher laws, special education funding, higher education funding, teaching as a profession. So that's just under children's and schools. And so guaranteed paid leave, fair wages and working conditions, gig workers or employees, expanded improved Badger care for all, pull down higher health care costs. There's a whole bunch of other ones there. Housing, finance, affordable construction, zoning reform, changes to property taxes. So like, I don't know if anything on here that's like taking power away from the managers and the owners of business.
Well, every time you bleed dollars from an organization or a company and push it towards the employees, you're sort of bleeding the ability to control their own companies because you're asking them to pay for childcare, you're asking them to pay for other things that she listed on that list. I guess.
But it's also, I mean, it's also taxes on individuals.
Yeah, so I guess my question about all
that
long list.
How is that blowing up capitalism?
Because it's not treating capitalism as a free market. We're letting companies do their thing.
You think we have a free market right now?
Not complete. Nothing's absolute. I mean, there are certain benefits given to certain companies. This has been the case since the start of our country, basically. Certain allowances for the railroad companies.
Our antitrust laws are not super strong
right now. Nor are they enforced properly in many cases. So I guess my question for all democratic socialists, when you make long lists like that, things you would like, how are you paying for that?
And that's a great question, right? Because I think that is, like I said, we clipped out some of our conversation from yesterday, and one of the critiques is that a 17% tax on the richest people in Wisconsin would drive people out. And that is an extreme take. And I mean, that comes up for debate, but that is one of the things that people are saying, like, that is a lot to potentially have the wealthiest leave this state.
She's Chris and I'm Steve. Quick break. It's a good start to the conversation. It's a big topic. Big topic.
It's a fun topic.
Yeah. And I think, with the power that right now a candidate like Francesca Hong has, which you could argue she's the leader in that race for the nomination, she's going to get a lot of attention and many of the things she's said and done and her ideas that you laid out.
Do you want to have her back on?
Absolutely.
All right. I'll share her text.
We should have all the candidates that are remaining.
So here's my question. Do you think it'd be better to get them in for the show or do a longer podcast with them and then play part of the podcast?
The latter, yeah, because you can get to more stuff.
Right?
Yeah, and stop trying
to... When we had Tom Tiffany on, it felt like we didn't get to half the things we wanted to talk to him about.
And whoever it is that's claiming we didn't ask Tom Tiffany about the election nonsense, that's the first question I asked him. I said it bothers me.
No, I think they're talking about more down ballot people. And we don't have, that's the thing that was hard about this show is like state senators, state like reps and stuff, being able to put all those people on air takes up a lot of time.
Yeah.
And so, but I think he meant, that texture meant more of the down ballot.
One of the things I don't like about Tom Tiffany and his campaign is the fact that they continue to play in the sandbox of 2020 was stolen, rigged. I hate that nonsense. I don't believe in that nonsense. And I don't care what the president says. It ain't going to get changed or nothing's going to happen as a result of these investigations or anything that the president says about it. It didn't happen. It was stupid then, which I said at the time, and it's stupid now. Spend some time in the first half hour. Chris and Bryce, DC Media and Point Taken on 620 WTMJ is where you're at. Talking about the rise of democratic socialism, not just in New York, but in other places, including the candidacy of at least one candidate here in Wisconsin for governor, Democratic nomination for governor, I should say. So I'm fast. This is not a pat myself on the back because I don't like the current situation, but I said a long time ago that the rise of Trump at some point will mean the decline of the Republican Party, at least the party that I know.
Well, I think that's happened.
Yeah, yeah. But when I said it years ago, that wasn't the case. Everyone was riding the wave, right? But we've seen, people sort of move away, and I certainly talk to a lot of voters when I'm out and about in all kinds of different contexts. And there's a few folks, the hold your nose folks, who say, well, I like his policy and that stuff, but those numbers seem to be shrinking a little bit. And the president's never been lower in his popularity numbers or unpopularity numbers, the rise of those. And we are seeing people who typically would have been depicted as like the holdouts.
Some of his bigger supporters.
Loyalists. So when you see quotes
through the election.
Yeah, when you see quotes like this, there are a lot of us that are absolutely fed up and will not support a party that betrays its voters and country. That does not mean returning into Democrats. We'll get to that point. But we are done with the America Last, L-A-S-T, all caps, Republican Party. Let's see. Here's another one. Tucker's not the only one who's done supporting the Republican Party. That is people who are basically joined at the hip what many people thought that was a conservative movement. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson, who I think he said it in his post.
So he said it
35 years he's been a Republican.
He said it in an interview. And so, yeah, he said, I'm out.
Podcast
Carlson said
yeah.
On an episode of Can't Be Censored podcast that aired Thursday, but gained traction online Monday. And then Marjorie Taylor Greene has also joined that of saying, I am no longer a Republican. And this goes back to a conversation you and I have said before, right? The frustration of certain Republicans, who are, like, when they answer a survey, say they disapprove of the president, they're not happy with the Iran war and all these things. But, like, is that enough to actually make you go vote for a Democrat? Or do you just stay home?
Yeah.
And it sounds like when you listen to the Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson, they're still on the side of, I don't know who I'll vote for. I don't know what this means for me, but I know I can't in good conscience vote for this party right now.
And if you're a Republican, both of those alternatives are bad, whether you vote, the person decides to vote for a Democrat, or they stay home. That doesn't help the Republican Party, their policy, their cause, their mission, whatever it is. And I'm trying to think, and we were chatting during the news break, of a person who sort of embodies just a banner, holding the banner for Donald Trump. And I said Sean Hannity on Fox. Almost every night it's basically a rip and read from the Republican Party and Donald Trump's talking
points.
So point.
Is your question basically like, who would it take to be like, if you lose this person,
yeah, then you're,
you lose everyone?
And for me, that's Sean Hannity.
I don't think there's anyone nearly as big as Trump. I mean, and this could be me misunderstanding the electorate and the base. But, like, I don't, you know, Tucker Carlson, wildly influential. Maybe, and I don't know how much has changed since he's left Fox or was forced out. Does it just matter as far as, like, social media presence and how many followers you have, but actual influence of, like, swaying votes? You know, who else do we throw up there? Because, like, Nick Fuentes, who I do not co-sign at all, but he's been on this same march right now, too. I think on his podcast, for however many people listen to it or show, was telling people to vote for Democrats to, like, ruin the Republican Party and all this stuff. But, like, I don't know. I don't know how many of it actually sways voters.
But here's how it matters, or here's why it matters. Because in the case of Sean Hannity or Ben Shapiro, who's been pretty critical of the president on several issues, those people are where a lot of conservatives get their messaging from. They watch Sean Hannity. His numbers are still great. Ben Shapiro still has, his numbers have declined significantly, but he still has a lot of people who listen to them. And a lot of other commentators across the country, some even local, that's where they get their messaging from. And if that pivots from basically whatever the president says, I'm going to say out loud, parrot those talking points on the radio, on TV, and my loyal listeners will follow along, to something like, I'm not sure, this is me being one of those squawkers, I'm not sure what the president's doing here. It makes no sense. If that messaging happens, then you've really lost it.
So stay with me, because I'm going to try to get to the point. So in the, you were here in 2016, right?
I didn't work on
You
radio.
Didn't work here yet, but you lived here.
Yeah.
And, you know, your predecessor, Charlie Sykes, longtime conservative talk show radio host, mm-hmm. Stood up to Trump in that kind of famous interview, right? Because mm-hmm. Charlie Sykes, not a fan of Trump. And for... I wasn't here, but I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, some of the other people on the station up the dial, there was more conservative talk radio folks in Wisconsin who were critical of Donald Trump in 2016.
Many of them thought he was going to lose the election.
And then slowly, obviously, over time, that shifted. So where does we are following the party line. We are following the messaging points of how we talk about these things. And this isn't just for talk radio. This is the entire ecosystem of conservative content creators that have been created and podcasters that are on payrolls from different foundations and yada, yada, yada. Like, where is the top of how the messaging gets pushed down? Like, who is there someone besides Trump that all of a sudden the light switch flips? And all of a sudden, the messaging all downstream flips on Trump.
I don't know if there's one person. I gave you a few names, but I mean, like, who else would there be?
I don't know. I'm genuinely curious.
The president's like, not going to change his mind.
At some point, conservative talk show radio, conservative voices didn't think Trump was the guy, and then all of a sudden they got in line. At one point, who makes the call that, like, we're not on this boat anymore, and we got to shift direction for the sake of our survival?
Well, what frames that debate and has for decades is liberals are evil, liberal policies bad, and every squawker since the 80s has basically hung on to that, including today. Where I think the...
I'm terrifying, apparently.
Yeah. Where the rubber meets the road, you want to lose everybody, and almost everybody except Donald Trump and, like, extreme loyalists, tank the economy, and blow up the markets where people are taking serious losses on their investments.
Well, the markets are still fine for now.
They're fine for now, but there's as Dave Spano likes to use the term uncertainty is not a good quality, good thing to have in, when we're looking at our investments. That's a warning sign. If the president, because of policy, because of statements, I'll throw this in just to irritate people, because of stupid things he says or decisions or just bizarre comments, loses almost all the regular conservative Republicans that I know that aren't crazy. I don't know how you make that work. And the way that it's going to be manifested is a loss, a horrific loss in the midterms. And if whatever the president thinks about Congress, whether he doesn't need them, man, you get blown out. He is going to be facing a firestorm. And there's some great reporting now that says basically the only reason he ran for president is to avoid jail time. I mean, it's a pretty interesting charge. And I have a hard time debating that charge. What do you think? 855-616-1620. Who's the person that aligns themselves so closely to Trump that just, if they flip, would you say, wow, can't believe it? 855-616-1620. She's Kristen. I'm Steve. Point taken. Steve and Kristen on this Wednesday edition. We asked for your ideas about the Republican media members or game changers or sort of those talking heads, squawking heads who sort of influence everyone else. The non-popular term would be lemmings, but I won't go that far. I mentioned Sean Hannity. Dan Bongino, podcaster, he'd be one. Texter said Scott Jennings.
Which is interesting because he was more on the side of, right? Because he was a Jeb Bush guy.
Yeah.
And so, because I know he's had a fairly public back and forth with Tim Miller,
yeah,
who of the Bulwark, also worked with Charlie Sykes, but, left the Republican Party after back in 2016. And Scott Jennings, I think, was much more critical of Trump back then versus the party line that he toes now. But I think the thing that's interesting with the talking heads, and I believe in our independence and that we're not, we actually say what we think and try to be interesting and are not in it for just the clicks. But ultimately, a lot of the people who work in media as pundits, whether they're podcasters, whether they're regulars on a CNN talk show, et cetera, their bottom line is different than the party winning, right? Like, their bottom line ultimately comes back to clicks, advertising revenue, popularity, influence. And for now, this is paying off. But like, who falls off when it's no longer paying off?
Here's the challenge.
I'm not saying all of them are like that, but I'm sure some of them follow where the dollar signs are as far as what, tell me what to say to make more money.
Yeah, and anybody who doesn't think that there are radio talkers or TV talkers, squawkers, that don't do what their station network tells them to do as a conservative voice or a liberal voice is nuts. And they're paid to do it.
Well, I don't mean just the TV. I don't mean just cable news. I mean, there's articles written about this, about the ecosystem of podcasters and content creators built out on the right. That's been, this is like the same playbook as talk radio starting in the 80s as far as how you influence the culture and the amount of people who are on payrolls from different organizations that aren't necessarily, like, this is the whole Tradwife thing. Like, where it's like, it's not overtly political, but it is subconsciously pushing certain values, pushing, like, there's a whole bunch of content creators that are young women for like the MAHA stuff, but also like trying to influence like getting off of birth control and how bad birth control is for you. And so things that are kind of disguised as health and lifestyle versus politics, but they're getting paid by political actors.
Yeah, I mean, this is such an interesting time in our country because we have certainly a president who likes to, royal the base, royal the country, say outlandish things, do some pretty interesting and crazy stuff. Not that everything he's done is crazy, I'm not saying that. But when we examine our lives and how we listen to the messaging, I've said it for a long time, we have to be more discerning. You said the same thing. Don't just, because, the algorithms will push all the stuff that you like, basically, in your face over and over again. I just had this conversation last night that your opinions start to be formed by a collective group of people who all sort of think like you. You're not getting a diversity of opinion. You can change that certainly by going after and following and liking people who are different, have different ideologies. So that is part of, under your control. But so much of why I tell people to get off their screens is because I think that's dangerous. And whether you watch Fox News for 12 hours a day or whatever the new name for MSNBC, what is it called?
MS Now.
MS Now, whatever that is. It's just not healthy. And when I hear people parrot things that I know the party has said, Texter used a great term, blind obedience. I don't care who you are, or what you believe in. That's a bad thing. You're just obedient because your party, your whatever, tells you you have to be. That's shallow, that's unintellectual, and that's lazy, and I don't like it. Don't
take my ball and going home.
I'm taking my ball and going home. All right, 10:52. Chris and Steve, point taken. Lots of great texts. Thanks to Peter and Jake and a lot of others who took the time to write. We can't possibly read them all, but I mean, it's an interesting debate, and obviously one's choices about where they consume things are their own personal choices. And you know, I've been yelled at for yelling at people about screen time. It's like, well, that's my business.
Oh, yeah. It was a nosedive. For people who are used to taking our survey and our newsletter, the amount of people who opted not to take this past week's survey was it was a small fraction of people who did not want to self-report what their screen time is.
But that does not make me not want to sort of push the envelope a little bit and say that you got to start looking at it. It's one thing to complain about the fact that we people act. Everyone's an internet expert now on everything. Thanks to the texter for putting that in my head. And everybody knows it all because they read something. And the way that people challenge each other now is, did you read that? Did you read something I read? That's not the way the world works. We all read our own things. If you want to share something, then share it and then ask them to comment on it. Don't say, did you read that? No, I didn't read that. I haven't read it. I read my thing, and my thing disagrees with your thing. And maybe we should talk about why we disagree. Maybe that's a more meaningful conversation.
Talking.
Communicating. Listening.
Asking questions. Being curious.
So I don't care if you're offended by the screen time question. Check it out, because you'll be shocked. And again, if you're double digits, you are part of the problem, my opinion. What do you think?
Unless it's Candy Crush, then you're fine. If you're just spending 8 hours
a day on Candy Wordle? Crush. What about Wordle? Boy, if you're taking that long on Wordle.
If it's a social media, check it out. But, you know, if you're just playing your games.
Somebody asked me.
Listening to us talk.
Somebody asked me about Wordle. I love the fact that people challenge themselves. I hate the fact that you want to tell me how you're challenging yourself.
I don't feel like people post their Wordle anymore.
Not
like,
as much.
You used to hate that.
Oh, it's just stupid.
When it first came out, you were so annoyed about
people
posting.
I used to post
posting.
About it.
Yes.
Stop.
But people still play. They just don't. I don't think you're not seeing it all over social media anymore.
Celebrate the concept. Don't celebrate you talking about the concept so much or how you did or didn't do. That's my hot take on a Wednesday.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Braun.
All right. Well, I did not realize, but for the first time in history, Congress actually got the votes for the War Powers Act, but it almost certainly will not stop the war. So February 28th was when the war started in Iran, and under the 1973 War Powers Resolution, the president gets 60 days to wage unauthorized hostilities, that's what we want to say, before Congress either declares war, authorizes the use of force, or the military action has to stop. Now, they got the votes in the House, then yesterday they got the votes in the Senate. Does this mean anything?
Great question. And I answered it. We were talking during a break about what we're going to talk about now, and so let's get to it. I said for maybe not the first time, but it's the early stages of some Republicans, because we had four Republicans. Collins was one. I don't know who the other three were off the top of my head. Joined all but one Democrat. And guess who that one Democrat was?
Fetterman.
Yeah, of course. I think he's just confused generally. But to say,
do you think he even runs again?
No. I think he's, even if he ran, I don't think he would win.
I don't know who's more unpopular by the time of their, as far as a Democratic elected senator, him or Kirsten Sinema?
No, that's a good question.
She was pretty unpopular by the time she did not run again as well. Anyways, go ahead.
So anyway, for one of the first times, I'm starting to hear and think, based on what I'm hearing and reading, that some Republicans are saying to the president, you can't just do whatever the hell you want. Because this president, tell me if you agree or not, this president just thinks he can do whatever he wants on any issue, almost, right? from tariffs to taxes to whatever.
Well, it'd be interesting. I want to read regime after you do.
Regime change.
Regime change. Sorry. Yes. Because I there was a fascinating. Where is it? This quote from a synopsis of, I think, because Meg Haberman and David Swan are doing their book tour now. And this is a tangent that maybe we can come back to. I said it to you yesterday. There is something that feels kind of icky about them sitting on all this information and publishing it in a book instead of writing about it in the New York Times, their employer, in real time. But I digress.
Yeah.
So this was an interesting quote from in the book. To the extent he still cared about polling at all, he, Trump, was seeing far fewer polls than during his first term. His advisors knew he was not receptive to being briefed on harsh realities. In his second term, unlike his first, he was willing to take breathtaking risks, risks that could throw not only his presidency, but the Republican Party and the entire world into chaos and carnage. More than ever before, as a president, he was operating on pure gut instinct. And so when I read some of the stuff as far as these are, you know, two journalists who have been following him for over 10 years now, especially Maggie Haberman, of analyzing how he's different this time around. And they talk a lot about him wanting, this is his legacy, right? As far as these risks that he's taking with Venezuela, with Iran, with tariffs, of like having his mark made of what he accomplished. And not necessarily thinking it all the way through as far as what the downside of what could happen.
Superficial.
But I think that's an interesting lens to look at it all through as far as what he, his mind frame of making these bold decisions and not necessarily wanting to be obstructed along the way.
This president believes if he says it, whatever that is, that thing is, it's true. Absolutely, he thinks that. If he says it, it's true. When he says, oh, there's gas under $2 a gallon. Really? Where's that at? When it was $4. Or American, you know, inflation's good. He, you know, and obviously that was a sort of a twisted context of that quotation that I like inflation is basically what he said, paraphrasing. He says things and he imagines them to be true. And you could probably talk to a psychiatrist and figure out what that means as far as how his brain works or maybe more appropriately doesn't work. We shouldn't be surprised, to the texter said, are we surprised? No, because this is how the president operates. And apparently, according to one of the texters, they watched some coverage. He's already belittling the Republicans who voted for the resolution. He doesn't care. He does things, silly things. Remember Greenland? Remember that? He was sending the vice president to Greenland to do what exactly? We're going to invade Greenland? This president says and does stupid things. But again, I understand he was elected president, and to some degree, he gets to do all those things. But at some point, we have a Congress. At some point, we have a high court. They also get to do and say things. And this president seems unwilling to ever listen to those other opinions. He thinks he's a unitarian president, where he solely makes all the decisions, solely has all the power. I don't think most Trump voters signed up for that. Some do, because clearly if you watched the front line on PBS that did this great piece on what some of the people that are closest to the president believe the power should be. And they're all aligned with that sort of thinking. That's dangerous. I had Rick Esselberg on the program, but you were gone. And he said, dangerous way of thinking that one person, president or not, gets to decide everything, every policy, every measure, everything we do as a country. And makes bold and outlandish statements. This is me talking now, not Rick. Bold and outlandish statements about what's going on in the country. It's a troubled nation. It's often a troubled nation because of the nature of politics. But it's more troubled because there is, again, to put a financial term in that Dave Spano uses, uncertainty. What's going to happen in the midterms? What happens to a lame duck president like this who's already... the kindest way I would put it is unhinged. How is he going to react to that when he can literally do nothing in that office?
Well, he can still do something.
He can talk.
We've had divided government before, and it's not like nothing got done. It's just a matter of, like, will there be any coming to the table to try to get anything done?
Yeah, I don't think
so. The last 2 years of Biden was divided government. The last, what was the split for Obama as far as how often he didn't have... Congress. It's not that part's not new. It's just his reaction to it is what is unknown. If he loses both chambers.
If there is a blue wave, and I'm not predicting it, because you never know with politics, things could change on a dime. This president will not react well to that reality. His reality will change because there will be an impeachment hearing. There will be. And, you know, obviously probably not going to get through the Senate, but I guess you never know what comes out in the hearing, what senators will finally say is enough. But I look at this, and this is a fundamental moment in our nation's history where all of these things are coming together. An unhinged president, an electorate that is just angry about all kinds of things, health care, economy, gas and groceries, all that stuff. They're just pissed about it. And what they do with that anger is so telling. And how, again, as much as I hope things work out for everybody and I want people to succeed and I want to have great lives and quality of life, I don't know how that's going to play in the White House. This if you believe Haberman and Swan, this president was super gluing gold things inside the Oval Office by himself. Who does that? I saw a story yesterday. They just took the paint off some of the columns of the White House. Are those going to be painted gold too? It's called the frickin' White House. What are you doing? Stop being, I said this to you yesterday. Is this president going to be known as the interior decorator president? A guy who, by the way, spends more on hair and makeup than most women did in the 70s? Give me a break. Let's govern. Stop saying stupid things and stop doing dumb things. And if that comes off as Trump derangement syndrome, don't care. I'm telling you what I see as somebody who's watched politics for a long time. Thoughts?
You know, you always put me in a corner when you you rant at me, because I never know where to go. I never know how to respond, because it's like, well, I don't disagree. But it's not necessarily an interesting conversation to just be like, uh-huh, ditto, cosign. Yeah. So on that note, let's take a break. This is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. He is Steve Scafidi. And as we change gears, there's some technology, AI stuff. I feel like there's like pillars of what we typically get drawn to for our topics. Basically, it's a lot of politics, a lot of Wisconsin. But certainly, and I don't know how you avoid it because it's obviously part of the culture now, but we do talk about technology a lot and what it is doing to us. So we're going to get to that a little bit later on. But we used to, on Wednesdays, spend the last half hour doing Ask Us Anything.
Mm-hmm.
We've now realized that our airtime is precious and that we can do Ask Us Anything as a podcast.
So we're going to sing.
Exactly. So if you have a question for us that you normally would ask us on air, text ASK to 855-616-1620. And we have a standing survey or like form where you can submit your question. And then Steve and I are recording in overtime today. And we will answer some of those.
Remember, yesterday you asked me like, One of your friends who said, "Do you guys actually like each other?" Wasn't that one of your friends?
He's like, "Do you guys actually get along off air?"
That's an interesting question.
But the one that we did last week was there was a listener who asked, "Will you both answer the Colbert questionnaire?"
We did that,
and we did that last week. So if you have not gone and listened to that, we put it in the newsletter. We got to check and see if Point works, but we can. It's in the podcast, and so we can get that to you because it was pretty interesting.
America's favorite newest podcast.
I'm not sure it's that new.
Newest podcast.
Yeah. I'm trying to see some of these questions.
I just love I'm always curious what people think or the questions they have. So it's a great opportunity. We'll even give you a shout out if you asked a great one.
If you put your name in there.
Yeah.
If you want a shout out, put your name in your question. But again, text ASK to 855-616-1620 if you have a question for Steve and I to answer on our podcast Overtime that we're recording today. And if you want to listen to the Colbert questionnaire from last week, you can text POINT 855-616-1620 and we'll send you the podcast link.
Award-winning podcast.
It is an award-winning podcast.
Best podcast, according to WBA, Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. And we had a great episode that we won that award for when we branded it as You Need to Listen, which I still love that name.
It's because you like to tell people what to do.
I do a little bit.
Yes, you do. Of course you do.
Don't most leaders?
Were you, you know the meme? You know the meme of the leader versus manager? Or like leader versus boss? And boss is up on like the carriage and the workers are pulling the carriage and leader is in front of like pulling everyone behind him? Which one are you? You leader or boss?
I'm helping everyone. I'll put it that way. I'm helping everyone do the best job they can do. And as much as I love telling people what to do, I love telling stupid people what not to do. That's my favorite. And I'm trying to be nice here before I say this, because I'm sure I'll get hate mail. There's a lot more stupid people than there needs to be, both in this market and beyond. And What does that mean? Just, they're not paying attention. They're.
You mean in the media, or you mean just like general public?
It hits all the brands. It hits all the spots. It's not unique to one job or one industry. There's a lot more stupid people than there needs to be. And you can...
Well, and AI... Here's the great thing. This is what we're going to transition to.
Yes.
And AI is not helping. Because there's a new report as far as how students and their lack of critical thinking and their lack of being able to write even more than 750 words and what we have to do to change routes. So we'll talk about that on the other side of this.
Artificial intelligence.
So I've had this conversation of how you use AI ethically and in a useful way. And I do think, having being the age that I am, gone through the schooling that I've gone through, there is a useful way to leverage it, right? As far as for the documentary right now, having it comb through the transcripts, of which there's 84 people, 51 transcripts, like 2 terabytes of footage, helping me find the patterns and stuff in that. That seems like a good use. But growing up with AI and trying to actually teach children how to think critically or to read a full book or just not have this crutch constantly helping you do the work is, I don't know how we're going to, I don't know what the guardrails are in this, but our, you know, Professor Galloway, Scott Galloway, who you and I both appreciate a lot. Mm-hmm. He wrote about this in his most recent, newsletter. But basically, kids are showing up to college, like, unable to think critically, like being gobsmacked that they're asked to read multiple books in a semester, certainly not being able to write 20 pages for a paper, let alone like 750 words. And it is terrifying to me, because I think it's also a downstream outcome of our culture as far as expediency, like grades, accomplishments, instead of the actual process of anything, right? Instead of the actual process of learning, we put priority on getting an A. And so in order to take shortcuts, whether that's cheating on a test, cheating on a paper, reading the Cliff Notes instead of the actual book, because what matters is getting the A, not the actual knowledge that you're gaining. Same thing in like the workplace, right? It's like, we just need results. And so you're finding shortcuts and ways to do things, do more faster, maybe not always better. But in a culture where we don't actually appreciate or value the process that get us the skill sets to be able to have an output, we are now subject to a tool that is like creates all these shortcuts for us. And the aftermath is people who actually don't know how to think.
Yeah.
But I know I've talked to some professors who it's like, it's oral tests, it's blue books, but like, it has to start younger than that. Cause this is in this newsletter, they were talking about, this is how kids are showing up to college.
I think you just nailed it. As much as we love technology, whether it's holding our smartphone, being able to access the world, or using artificial intelligence to do a lot of different things, to process things, to look at data, to quickly analyze something, the ability to judge someone's education, how much they've learned, is a face-to-face, one-on-one thing. You can still assess people that way. And as much as we love technology, why would we hire people to be professors and teachers and educators and not let them use those skill sets they've built into their own brains by using the educational system to be able to say to someone, you know this, tell me what it is. And if they don't, you haven't learned. We also have to have parents willing to support an educational system that tells them their kids aren't geniuses. That has to happen. Because one of the things that has happened, I think, and it's a cultural observation, is that parents have dumbed down the system and not let their kids make mistakes, which we all know they learn from.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, along with Steve Scafidi, as always, a ranty Steve from earlier.
And thanks for all the feedback. I don't expect everyone to agree with me.
That is the point of this.
Exactly.
That is the point.
And I'm generally...
It's very boring if we're milk toast with...
Yeah.
That's what someone told me the other day. We were, while we were on air, the guys being some of the producers and people, I guess we're having some debate about first date questions. And I came back and I had a very nuanced answer.
Okay.
And I'm like, that's boring. So we're talking about the influence that AI is having on the learning ability of kids, and that they're showing up to university not nearly as prepared because they're outsourcing their thinking ability to this machine that can pump out a paper, help you with your math, like all these things as far as doing the actual friction work of learning, which is hard, right? It is hard to memorize things. Speaking of memorizing things, I just had this flashback as I said that to my, when I was still at community college in Santa Monica, I took a physical anthropology class where I had to fit, like, the amount of memorization in that class, I had to be able to look at different, like, skulls and fossils for our test and say which lineage of pre-Homo sapien, like, was it a Neanderthal?
Look at you.
Like, I had to look at, like, hip bones and tell you, or like a pelvis and tell you if it was a male or a female.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the amount of memorization and how hard I worked to get an A in that class. Like it, but I remembered it, right? Because I did that work, and it's certainly not applicable to anything I do for work now. But what are we gonna do? Because it's here. And I read that this morning as a mom of a young child who I have very high hopes for how smart and capable she will be. And it's like, what do I do to make sure that she, not that she gets good grades, that she learns how to think and think well and think critically? Like, I have flashbacks to friends who, I had a friend in college who one of her punishments when she got in trouble was she'd have to go read the dictionary. And so she had an incredible vocabulary.
Mm.
I've heard of other families where it's like you had to memorize poems or memorize different things. And so because it was like, you know, at the time as a kid, you're like, this is terrible. But what it does to your brain. So it's like, do you have to be more of a strict parent as far as extracurricular or extra work at home to make sure your memory, your learning, like all of those things you're still exercising in case school isn't?
We were chatting up during the break about the role of parents, and I'll tie it to education. I said it may be the most critical point. I said it a different way, but the most critical time in our nascent history about how we interact with education. So obviously education is important. If I had to teach my kids, they're grown, calculus, they would never learn calculus. So therefore, we need an educational system to do that. But I did, and I was able to impart to my kids the value of proper communication, verbal skills, all the things that a parent can shape them by daily conversations, nightly conversations. Now, I'm the first one to say that because of my work requirements early in my career, I traveled a lot. And thankfully, my wife, Kathy, was a teacher, also helpful, and was able to, at the end of the day, still teach, but in a different way, to our two daughters.
And she could also teach them calculus.
She could teach them calculus, which she was heavily relied upon by friends, neighbors, and family.
Yeah, because
that's a specialized skill set, and I'll remind people she's got a math degree. So that's a high level of intelligence. But I think the point is, for me, parents, there's so many distractions now. You got to cut that down. That's part of the whole screen time argument and what you're doing, what we're doing with education.
But also
minimize.
But for the sake of society, we can't only rely on parents.
No, we can't. That's
right.
Why
because
a team.
If you're like, this is a parent's job. Like, this is the, you know, sometimes we get text messages on, well, it starts at home. And for certain, you know, whether it was like the rise of the Kia boys a couple years ago and different, the street takeovers and things like that, where you like, you want to blame the parents, but it's like, how do you legislate better parenting?
That's a tough thing.
Especially if you're a conservative or a libertarian, like what is the overreach there? And so the reaction to that is like, this is why we have public school, because we want an educated electorate who's part of like civic society. And so part of this is still investing in schools and investing in teachers and making sure that there is like a well-rounded curriculum so that, you know, a rising tide raises all boats.
It's why I resist the temptation. I will be critical of schools, but I understand the value of schools. And I'm not going to blow up the educational system because some people don't like it, or get rid of the Department of Education, which this president has.
What's the status of that?
They still have a secretary, but I mean, she's sort of streamlining that. And at some point, the goal, if at least what's the project?
125
is to just get rid of it. Not a fan, but I certainly think we can look at how we, you know, demonstrate how we teach kids and all those things. And you mentioned yesterday, I'm a sort of back to basics guy, but I don't want to shirk all the other things, because going back to the technology piece, we're all going to be impacted by AI in some pretty significant ways. So you have to understand it. But again, I'll go back to what I said before. Minimizing distractions in education is one of the most fundamental things we can do. And the way you don't legislate better parenting, you become, by example, a better parent. And you have to demonstrate it individually, your household, make better life choices, make better decisions. And gradually, that becomes entrenched in society. Those are great examples. Aren't those great parents? That becomes the lesson, and not all the bad examples that we trot out every day about people being bad parents and what happens to their kids. We focus on that negative stuff so much. There's a tremendous number of great parents out there. We should celebrate those stories as well. And I think doing some of those things, utilizing the best of technology and not the worst, minimizing distractions, focusing, not expanding all of our choices. More choices aren't necessarily better. They're different. They're more expansive. They're more diverse. Not necessarily better for kids. Kids are learning. And get back to that. Get back to the face-to-face. If a teacher is challenged by technology in their classroom, then minimize the technology. As painful as that might be, even when your district is jamming it down your throat because they're paying for it, and different curriculums and all the things that we pay money for. Maybe that's part of the problem with schools. They pay for a lot of things that become the hot topic or a hot way to do things. And then 3 years later, they have the new presentation and they throw it all out and do it again. That's redundant. It's expensive and probably leads to some of the problems we're talking about. God, I'm doing a lot of ranting today. My day to rant, Talking Wednesday. She's Kristen, I'm Steve Point Taken. Kristen and I would be called great communicators by some people. We're also great listeners, and we are going to listen to your suggestions for a question that stands out for a little bonus piece of content at the end of our overtime podcast, which we're recording this afternoon. Any question, we'll take the best one, and we'll even give you some credit, maybe shout out on it. But it's got to be good. Ask, it could be anything, politics, sports, Giannis, Kristen's acting career, whatever it is. What you most like about summer? You were playing around with some questions during the break.
Yeah, as we just got off the topic of outsourcing thinking to AI.
Yeah, who went to ChatGPT?
You're like, I want to change it up, because we were going to do more AI stuff as far as the national security threat
that's a whole
ever-changing AI is causing. But we'll save that for another day. So he's like, let's do something fun. And I was like, well, what fun thing do you want to do?
How about instead of smells? Because that's the one he came up with.
He was like, ask ChatGPT. So we are also outsourcing thinking sometimes. So this was, what's the one summer smell, sound, or taste that instantly takes you back?
Yeah, we both said watermelon.
I said watermelon. The other thing is like a really good summer thunderstorm. The smell of that.
Yeah.
That only really happens in the Midwest. Like when I lived in California, that wasn't as much of a thing.
No, because you don't get that many. What thing or events, don't say Summerfest, outside of Summerfest or State Fair, which are very popular, makes you think, yeah, this is summer. This is summer. Is it a picnic? Is it a parade?
This is an obvious answer, but like since we just had summer solstice, it's the late nights. It's like yesterday, we had to take Frankie to the doctor and all this different stuff. And so ultimately our best friend, and certainly Frankie's best friend, I just called. I was like, are you guys home? I needed her to get some energy out. And so we just sat on their deck and the two of them ran around in their underwear playing with like squirt guns.
Being a kid.
And it was 6:30 and still warm and sun was out. And I was just like, a summer evening on a porch with kids running around feels very much like summer is
this
here.
One hits both. It's a thing and a smell. Roasted corn.
Ooh.
As soon as you smell, yeah, you're not eating that in the wintertime.
No.
You can buy corn, I guess, in the winter, and you could do it in some weird way. But you smell that. You go to a state fair, especially, because I think New Berlin's Lions have been doing it for like decades. You smell that. That's summer to me. Watermelon. An ice cold beer in the summer after cutting the grass. Miller High Life bottle. Nothing better.
How about the first sight of fireflies?
Fireflies?
That was, I never talked about this aspect, but I gave a shout out to Camp Kettlewood in East Troy, where we did my birthday weekend. I've never seen as many fireflies in my adult life as I saw out there. Because there was all these stories as far as they're kind of, there's less and less of them, right? We had friends who came in from California who live in San Diego, and the kids were just mesmerized. But there was a, because it was what, the Saturday, the 12th, 13th? 13th. And there was, out in that part of town or the state, there was like heat lightning. So it wasn't actually a thunderstorm. But at one point, Mike and I were looking out onto kind of the field, and there was lightning in the sky, but no thunder and no rain, and just thousands of fireflies because it's, you know, you're out in the country. And I was like, this is very cool.
So, personal story. So every summer, around like July 4th, the fireflies return to our backyard.
Okay, so you get them in your backyard.
Oh, my God. Okay. So it goes from a few, then if you wait a week or two, so by end of July, maybe mid-July, fireflies, and it's just, it's mesmerizing. We just sit out on our patio and just watch them.
That's cool.
Oh, it's
not
it
a lot
cool.
of fireflies in the city of Milwaukee.
No, but we're in the suburbs. So, I mean, that's sort of a cool way to sort of celebrate summer. A couple of people mentioned fireworks. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, although there's fireworks in the winter, too. Picking sweet cherries at Sir Reginald's in Brussels after that one day closer to winter. And thanks for the questions that are coming in. Some good ones that we'll pick the best one and answer it as best we can at the end of our overtime podcast, which will be recorded this afternoon and published tomorrow?
Tonight? Probably, yeah. So if you, I'll take some of the questions that are coming in right now and put them in there. But if you would like to ask us a question, you can always text ASK to 855-616-1620. Fill out that form, and then we will answer it on our overtime podcast.
And here's something that I don't often do, but because we would like to brand our podcast, it's an opportunity for someone, if you'd like to be associated with our podcast.
You mean a sponsor.
Sponsor, yeah.
It's already branded.
Yeah, sponsor our podcast. That opportunity exists, and we got some really cool graphics that we're doing now. We got a new podcast studio.
We do.
Some great technology, so we're ramping it up.
Do we have better lighting today? Did anyone figure that out?
I have no idea. We'll find out when we get in the recording studio. We're going to be challenging it because I have a lot of podcasts to record there in the next weeks and months ahead. So lots of work to do. I love this text. This is a great way to go to break. Summer, Bob Uecker's voice.
Mm.
Brilliantly done by the texture from the 414. That's exactly the right answer. All right, we'll take our final break of the show. And you know what the show is. It's Point Taken on 620 WTMJ.
Well, since your dad is a meteorologist, as we all know, I'm surprised you didn't correct me, but the texture sure did. There is no such thing as heat lightning. It is simply, I guess it's a folk term for when you see lightning but don't hear the thunder or feel the rain. But it's simply, it's just normal lightning. The storm is just too far away.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't correct me. Did you know that?
I really didn't think about it that much.
Okay.
You were thinking
about what you were going to say next?
Yes, I was sort of half paying attention.
Hard right now. I don't know if I've done this on air yet. So every once in a while, especially during the grab bag on Fridays with Bill and Joe, I'll go back and I'll edit something I said for social media. And I often, in the editing process, you know, want to go to Joe or Bill or Steve's reaction as I'm saying stuff. But I rarely can ever go to Steve's reaction because often when I'm talking, he's looking at the computer. He's looking at the clock. He's not listening to me. And so I was like, I'm going to blow him up if I put his face just not paying attention to me talk. So I just have to cut you out of the video.
Well, I often already know what you're going to say anyway.
That's not true.
Oh, yes, it is.
No,
very,
it's
very
not.
Predictable. Very predictable. All right. So get those questions in. We'll pick the best one. We'll do it as part of our overtime recording this afternoon. Could be a busy day for the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow.
I guess hopefully it is.
Well, that's what they're predicting.
Because otherwise, there's like 12 cases left that they still have to announce.
So we have James Santel on standby. Of course, Jeremy Janine, who always joins us on Thursdays, all the great local stories. There's a lot to talk about, actually. So looking forward to that. We're going to have fun this afternoon. I want you to have fun. Enjoy the summer. Today is the rain day. After today, the weather gets spectacular for the rest of the week. So we're going to enjoy that. That's all about summer. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Actually, see you this afternoon. Thanks for listening.